Compared with the scheme of things in the 17th and 18th centuries, the state of affairs in the contemporary Iceland is different. Nevertheless, inspired by a strange coincidence, one does wonder if history might have repeated itself under a different banner.
Welcome to the University of Manitoba Icelandic Radio Journal, a series of short documentaries highlighting Icelandic culture in Winnipeg. This edition features Dr. Birna Bjarnadóttir, Chair of Icelandic Studies at the University of Manitoba, giving a presentation entitled Iceland's Bell Revisited. As an introduction to this presentation, we'll read the opening paragraphs from Iceland's Bell by Halldór Laxness. These paragraphs read as follows. There was a time, it says in books, that the Icelandic people had only one national treasure, a bell. The bell hung fastened to the ridge pole at the gable end of the courthouse at Thingvellir by Uxará. It was rung for court hearings and before executions, and was so ancient that no one knew its true age any longer. The bell had been cracked for many years before this story begins, and the oldest folk thought they could remember it as having a clearer chime. All the same, the old folk still cherished it. On calm midsummer days at Thingvellir, when the fragrance of Bláuskógar wafts in on gentle breezes from Súlur, the regent, the magistrate, and the executioner, the man to be hanged and the woman to be drowned assembled at the courthouse, and the chime of the bell could often be heard mingled with the murmur of Uxará. One year, when the king decreed that the people of Iceland were to relinquish all of their brass and copper so that Copenhagen could be rebuilt following the war, men were sent to fetch the ancient bell at Thingvellir by Uxará.
What a bizarre coincidence. A character states in the bold soprano, written by one of the masters of absurd drama, Eugene Ionesco. These words came to mind recently, for when Iceland's economy crashed, Iceland's Bell by Halldór Laxness was on the reading list at the University of Manitoba's Department of Icelandic. The novel, written around the time Iceland received its independence from Denmark in 1944, is a historical piece describing events that took place during the late 17th and early 18th centuries. At the time, the people of Iceland were suffering, not only because of famine and plague, but the country was also severely oppressed by the Danish monopoly on trade. The novel's opening scene, or the cutting down of Iceland's Bell at Þingvellir, the site of the old parliament, is for some an indication of this author's courage, ferrying the reader straight into the climax itself, namely Iceland's ultimate humiliation. Compared with the scheme of things in the 17th and 18th centuries, or the way in which a group of Danish merchants manipulated their king to allow them to manage Iceland's goods, the state of affairs in the contemporary Iceland is different. Nevertheless, inspired by a strange coincidence, one does wonder if history might have repeated itself under a different banner. When the banks of Iceland were privatized some years ago, the group in power is not reported to have exhausted itself with observing regulations at hand. Somewhat unrestrained in a free-flowing and at the time globally approved neoliberal spirit, a group of politicians and bankers orchestrated the design of what was termed as Iceland's economical boom. Iceland could have a real chance on the stage of the global market, we were told, and the country's blossoming economy would serve as a crucial tool in creating a prosperous image of Iceland abroad. Despite the conflicting messages sent from the land of gleaming beauty, or the promotion of the naturally unspoiled, blue lagoonish, otherworldly scenario, along with a heavy industry sellout of the country's highlands. Many were taken in by the wonders of Iceland's geysir-like finance sector. Icelanders themselves were no less seduced by the gold rush, too thrilled to realize that the gold mines were the newly privatized banks. For a while, the surface of things remained polished, so spotless in fact that the flawed alchemists managed to export the ice save method to foreign countries. Shortly after the crash took place, someone received the following statement in a letter from a faraway place. Thieves are not to be trusted with anything apart from the act of theft. Does this mean that the entire nation of Icelanders is caught up in the act? One could ask. Not necessarily, or no more so than the Danish merchants in the 17th and 18th centuries represented, at the time, the entire population of Denmark. However, just as the Danish king was undeniably an active player in the way things were run back then, with a little help from a small and privileged group of Icelandic officials, the democratically elected authorities in the Republic of the present-day Iceland have demonstrated a seemingly light-hearted relationship with the concept of responsibility. We could, of course, decide to limit ourselves somewhat in our inquiry and blame Iceland's present misfortune on the global state of affairs. However, if that is to be the route taken, one needs to acknowledge the fact that there is a difference between Iceland and, let us say, other Nordic countries. No other Nordic country has been as prolific in applying the economical system Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher are responsible for. And the result of this, one could ask, who knew that Iceland was just a hedge fund with glaciers? Thomas L. Friedman asked in an article published in the New York Times on a Sunday, October 19th, titled The Great Iceland Meltdown. And this is the story according to this Friedman. The three banks that make up almost the entire banking system in Iceland grew quickly on easy credit, and their combined assets rose tenfold in 5 years. The Icelandic banks, while not invested in US supreme mortgages, had gone on their own borrowing and lending binges, wooing savers from across Europe with 5.45% interest saving accounts. And later in the same article, one can read the following. So think about it. Some mortgage broker in Los Angeles gives supreme liar loans to people who have no credit rating so they can buy homes in Southern California. Those flimsy mortgages get globalized through the global banking system, and when they go sour, they eventually prompt banks to stop lending, fearful that every bank's assets are toxic too. The credit crunch hits Iceland, which went on its own binge. Meanwhile, the police department of Northumbria, England, had invested some of its extra cash in Iceland, and now that those accounts are frozen, it may have to reduce street patrols this weekend. And therein lies the central truth of globalization today. We're all connected, and nobody is in charge. End of quote. And the future, to quote Thomas Friedman again, it will be a world in which America will not be able to scratch its ear, let alone roll over in bed without thinking about the impact on other countries and economies. And it will be a world in which multilateral diplomacy and regulation will not longer be a choice. it would be a reality and a necessity. We are all partners now. End of quote. Are we partners, really? When discussing the question of race in an interview on her new novel titled A Mercy, Toni Morrison had this to say. It's not about difference, it's about hierarchy. End of quote. The global finance market might be operating by the same unwritten and powerful man-made laws. Iceland's experience on the stage of global financing inspires one, at least, to be doubtful of any partner talk, the enterprise being a slippery tool for the very few countries capable of promoting the illusion of responsibility and thus providing the complex mechanism needed in order to participate in and safeguard the system. In response to a crisis of two of the three Icelandic banks, the former Empire Britain ran out of all options but activating the terrorist law. This resulted in a widespread shunning of a country of 330,000 inhabitants, followed by a heavy load of debts shipped to Iceland, the country already on the brink of bankruptcy. The Danish monopoly on trade in the 17th and 18th centuries is beginning to feel like a child's play. What is no less disturbing is that the group of the well-dressed, memorably polite, soft-spoken, and admirably focused businessmen from contemporary Iceland became, at some point, known as heroes, descending from the medieval saga flock. What does it mean to have a group of flawed alchemists promoted in the name of a cultural heritage, one could ask? Is the rumor perhaps true that these are the times of the globally managed Republic of the Kiosk, characterized by unmasked, magnificently twisted cultural replicas? Has the moment perhaps arrived when mankind should begin to talk less about economy, which is a symptom, and start to focus on the crisis of wounded culture? I cannot speak for other countries, but as noted some decades ago by Sigurður Nordal, a professor of Icelandic literature at the University of Iceland, the experiment called Iceland might have been a failure if it were not for the sagas. Halldór Laxness, the author of Iceland's Spell, and the one who received the Nobel Prize Award in Literature in 1955 for revitalizing the epic tradition in Icelandic literature, was of the opinion that a nation's true value could only be measured by its culture. He was also someone to acknowledge culture's volatile nature, being a legendary interpreter of the far from clear-cut challenges of the saga heritage. His Iceland Spell does have a fair maiden, the one crowned with Iceland's sun, only to be writing in black before the final scene comes to an end, casting a shadow over the eyes of the ever-hopeful reader. A bleak style, some have also claimed, executed by an author who went on a journey into a pitch-black chapter of Iceland's history. As mentioned by Adam Haslett in his introduction to Philip Rawton's English translation of the novel, in a piece which lends itself to an expression of national identity and the role literature plays in forming it, and being also a tale of colonial exploitation and the obdurate will of suffering people, This description might indeed lead one to imagine an earnest, patriotic work, which Iceland's spell most certainly isn't. End of quote. And why is that? If we are to believe Hazlitt, Laxness has done here what so many other writers who reach for large historical themes fail to do. He's retained his sense of the absurd. When searching for old and scattered medieval manuscripts in rundown farms in 17th century Iceland, one of the novel's protagonists, Arnars Arnæus, a character based on Árni Magnússon, Iceland's most famous manuscript collector, this is what he observes. It has now come down to this. These people who have since antique possessed the most distinguished litteras in the northern part of the world, choose now to walk upon calfskin or to eat calfskin rather than to read the old words written upon calfskin. End of quote. In a spirit of the absurd, let's call upon another master and cite the final sentence in Beckett's Endgame. Let us pray to God. Or in Saga Island's language, let us pray for the grave of fire.
The University of Manitoba Icelandic Radio Journal is a joint production between the Department of Icelandic Language and Literature at the University of Manitoba and also UMFM 101.5. More information can be found either at umfm.com or umanitoba.ca/Icelandic.